Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. That's Monday through Friday in the United States. That's 5 till 7 Central, 3 till 5 Pacific, and 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for those of you, the minority of the fans who actually have the ability to listen live. I really appreciate it. Quite significantly. And of course, in New Zealand, we broadcast live from the future. So instead of Monday through Friday, it's Tuesday through Saturday. So you can tune in on Saturday mornings instead of watching the cartoons and eating sugary cereals, perhaps. I don't know. It should be nice. Anyway, I believe we have a guest today, Dr. Bob Melamed, who is a famed and prolific cannabis researcher. I'm not 100% sure if he's there with us at the moment. Bob, are you there?
I'm here.
All right, excellent. Got your shirt on?
I do.
All right. We can turn your camera on now then, I guess.
Well, my camera should be on. Oh, wait, no. Sorry. There we go. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there we go. That's more like it. Okie dokie. Right, so Bob, for those who are unfamiliar with your work, let me just explain a bit for the thing. If you've heard about Rick Simpson, ladies and gentlemen, you know, with the hemp oil and what have you, Bob's a good colleague of Rick's. And he's also the discoverer, well, or at the very least, if he didn't discover it, he certainly is promoting it, the idea of endocannabinoids, otherwise cannabinoids from within. You didn't discover it. Yeah, I didn't think so. But the point being is that this is a incredible discovery that isn't really talked about quite so often, which is interesting because of its significance. Endocannabinoids regulate everything in the body, how it's structured, how it regenerates, everything. And this, in my mind, gives a very simple explanation as to why cannabis hemp oil of the Rick Simpson methodology seems to basically cure anything, because it's based upon cannabinoids, which basically run everything in your body. Or at least that's been my assessment of the situation and assumption, and I could be wrong. Am I wrong, Bob?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's really what I've been spreading, that word in particular, because of the way I understand what life is from a physical point of view. One of the things that is emphasized in that scientific realm is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So the fact that we have an endocannabinoid system that does regulate everything in our body from conception till death, you know, your immune system, digestive, cardiovascular, skin, bones, muscle, everything in your body is regulated by the pot that your body makes. And thankfully, the medical marijuana community has been very receptive and enthusiastically embraces the science, because it explains why they are having so many diverse benefits from so many different preparations and strains, et cetera. It gives them a scientific foundation. So unfortunately, the doctors lag far behind, and most of the educators as well, for that matter. But the people on the street who it's changing their lives are also educated, and they spread that to their friends and family. So we have a burgeoning community, really, in the extended medical marijuana community of people who know the truth, and it is backed up by science. So what I try to do is encourage that, you know, pluralistic approach, and provide them with the science in understandable fashion, as I understand it, because a lot of my thinking is somewhat radical, I think. But I believe it. I'm actually very conservative scientifically, so if I believe it, I beat it up a long time.
How exactly did you stumble across this discovery?
Well, I've been a cannabis user for 50 years now, you know, since I was 16 years old. So as the science unfolded, being a scientist myself, you know, a PhD in biochemistry and molecular genetics, and being actively involved in science, my field in particular had been radiation damage to DNA and how our cells repair it. And since that fundamentally involves free radicals, which is what cannabis helps protect against, it was a very easy transition because I knew so much of what was going on. As the cannabis endocannabinoid chemistry started to unfold...
Isn't it interesting how cannabis protects you from free radicals at the same time turning you into one?
Yeah, I've thought of that. I like that little paradox. But, you know, the reason for that is that the world really can be divided into two halves, people who have above average and people who have below average endocannabinoid levels regulating things like open-mindedness. So the half that has below average, they don't have the ability to biochemically properly buffer stress.
Is that not a contradiction?
They don't want change.
Is that not a contradiction in terms regulating open-mindedness?
No, not at all. Because everything that we are comes from what we are. Our biochemistry, which emerges from our genetics and our interaction with our environment and how those two come together. So we all have certain levels of any measurable, open-mindedness being one of them. So it's an intrinsic truth that you're going to have a distribution of people who are more and less often open-minded. And the people who are more closed-minded would be people who will have lower levels of cannabinoid activity.
Has this been a blood tested or something of that nature? Like you take a very, very open-minded person and a very closed-minded?
The way it's been demonstrated is you can make what's called a knockout mouse where you eliminate a gene. So you can eliminate the CB1 receptor, which is the gene that conveys the biological impact of psychoactive cannabinoids to the brain. And you can knock that out so you have mice that don't have it. And you can show in what's called a Morris water maze. You put both normal mice, wild type as they're known, and the knockout into this big tank of cloudy liquid, and they have to swim, and they don't like to swim. And they find a platform, and then they climb out, and they learn where that platform is. So when you take them out and you put them in, they go to the platform. And if you change the position, they both kind of freak out again because it's not where they were accustomed to it being, and they explore and search and eventually find it again. Now, if you take the mice out, the normal mice, and put them back in, they go to where that platform now is. Whereas if you take the cannabis deficient mice and put them back in, they go to the old position. They don't go to the new one. So they couldn't rewire. They were both able to learn the first time, but it was not capable. The knockout mice, one knockout mice, in other words, mice that were completely non-high. Because we're all high to a certain degree. We're high to the degree that genetics and our nutrition and our environment allows us to be high. And some people are less high and they're typically depressed. So, you know, what do they need? They need a little cannabis to activate their cannabinoid system. Mm. So, that's what's going on.
Now, if that's the case, blips and flips, the backward-looking people and the forward-looking people, and naturally blips make their way to the high-up positions in politics, media, business, churches, etc., because they don't require any real freedom of thinking. They require indoctrination. They require hierarchy. Now, this would be why the society itself is crumbling, because the flips don't want to control other people. They just want to be free. And the blips want control and power and want to loud it over everybody else. Why is that?
Because it's their biochemistry. You see, if change causes cellular stress, and you don't have the ability to biochemically accept that in a way that is not basically degradative. In other words, free radicals are damaging. If instead you can use the free radical signals to arm your resources to protect against them, that's adaptation. And the cannabinoids are involved in that. So if you have sufficient cannabinoids, you're more able to biochemically adapt. And one of the manifestations of that, because everything is built on top of one another like a big fractal, is your mental stress levels. And we know that stress regulates, you know, your immune system, and you get sick if you're too stressed, etc. It's part of whether or not you're able to take the energy from your environment that sustains your very existence, because we are what's called flow-dependent structures. You know, we need food input and air input, and we got to get rid of the waste. And if you stop either end, then you stop the whole thing. So we are flow dependent, and the free radicals are intrinsically made on the one hand just by the fact that we burn food. You eat food, you're going to make free radicals. But whether or not that you're making too many for your body to adapt, and whether your genetics is in a healthy enough place and your food is better, allows you to adjust and embrace change. You know, one of the characteristics of people who use cannabis is that they are optimistic. Well, think what optimistic means. It means you don't know what the future holds, but you believe it's going to be good. That's what an optimist is. So you're ready to embrace the future, whereas if you're cannabinoid deficient, you're afraid of it because it's an unknown, and if you have to change anything, that becomes stressful, and you wind up making more free radicals in a way that degrades you rather than adapts you to change.
So ergo, they will structure society in such a way where change to their position in life never happens so that they can feel comfortable and reduce the amount of stress, even if that means killing everybody on the planet, including themselves.
Well, as long as they can make more money and feel secure with weaponry, you know, that's the way they're programmed. And the thing is, in life, everything is a balance of opposing forces. The question is, where is the thermostat set? And the thermostat today, I believe, needs to be turned in terms of you need to increase your cannabinoid activity. I think that the distribution of human biochemistry on the planet needs a higher level of cannabinoid activity in order for us to be more harmonious and embrace the future with less fear than our current thermostat setting. And the way to do that is now, because of the incredible medicinal values that are being demonstrated, they can't stop this anymore. And what we need to do is replace the blips that run the world with the forward-looking people so we can embrace change and create a healthy dialogue with our environment as well as our international neighbors.
Do you believe that there are actually people for whom which cannabis is actually harmful?
Yes, I do. I think that the most talked about one probably is the closest to that situation. First of all, we're all different. You know, if you take a strain, if you go to do a biological experiment with mice that are isogenic, meaning they all come from this, they have the same DNA, they're all brothers or sisters, and you treat them the same way, they're all growing up in the same cages, fed the same food, you don't get the same results biologically. Because what really makes every individual on the planet, including twins, totally different, is how their biochemistry is flowing. And it's guided by, of course, your genetics and your environmental history. But it's still flowing in such a fashion that it's totally impossible for any two to ever be the same. That's like a ludicrous thought. And yet, depending on, you know, how that is flowing and vibrating, so to speak, you can become more or less susceptible to any kind of positive or negative interaction as your being unfolds in time.
Mm. Well, it's just because I've noticed that there are some people who are, we all take drugs in society. You know, we either take caffeine or alcohol or cannabis. Or some people like even stronger stuff or cigarettes or whatever. And I've noticed some people are perfect, you know, they're fine when they're drinking, But when they smoke cannabis, they kind of fly off the handle, regardless of whether or not they're drunk at the time, and they become kind of weird. Others, on the other hand, are really, really good and always happy and on a good buzz when they're smoking, yet turn into complete crazy people when they're drunk. And it's my contention that there's probably a drug for everybody, and there's probably many people that shouldn't take any kind of drug at all. And it's just about, you know, finding what your balance is, what your poison is, so to speak. But the problem is all of the drugs that are listed there are harmful apart from cannabis, which doesn't really cause any physical damage.
Well, it does the opposite of not causing physical damage. It's an anti-aging drug.
You know? We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with Dr. Bob Melamede.
Speedwain rappers, but I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial.
The welcome back. So electrical, it'll pump your heart. Uh-oh. Okay, we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on AmericanFreedomRadio.com with my very special guest, Dr. Bob Melamede. What's your website, Bob? Is it like CannabisScience.org or something?
No, we have CannabisScience.com.
Okay. Right, no, now.
For Cannabis Science.
CannabisScience.com. All right. Now, behind me, I have a picture of some lesions. One might even call it the Lesion of Doom. We have... could you actually describe this for the listeners here, Bob? Because it's quite a significant discovery when you sent me this, and I think you sent me this this PDF years ago. And the guy who suffered these particular lesions is now dead, but not because of the lesions and things of that nature, but because of the hospital. And he died of an infection or something. So could you give us a walkthrough about what we're looking at here?
Yeah, well, this guy had gotten very extensive skin cancer. He lived in Hawaii for a while, in Australia, and fair skin. So he wound up getting, unfortunately, a squamous cell, which is a little more dangerous than basal cell, and he ignored it for years until... He came totally out of control, and he had lesions extending off the top of his head, literally a few inches. And the doctor wanted to basically cut off not only the tumor, but his scalp and part of his skull, and then put it back. After it was a whole story. He said, no, no, no. And then he sends him to a radiologist. The radiologist irradiates his head 130 times. He also had chemo. And what was left would... Drug-resistant cancers. Drug-resistant cancers, when you do things that would normally kill a drug-sensitive cancer, actually often wind up promoting their growth. And that's what was happening with them. They were growing faster whenever they were treated. And we spoke, and he eventually was able to get cannabis oil and use that. And it basically ate into his head. There are other pictures. I don't know if you have them there. No, not of his head. You got some there. Yeah, no, that's an old one. It ate everything you see there kind of fused. If you go back to your original set, everything, you know, each those three lesions that you see fused into one massive hole that was eaten down to his bone. And his doctor's comment was that this is amazing. We have nothing that will do this. And, it proceeded. It looked like it was starting to heal up around the edges. And at that point, he wound up in the hospital for something else and got a hospital infection, you know, drug-resistant hospital infection. They gave him antibiotics that he was allergic to. His oncologist came and visited him at one point and said, I hate to tell you this, but the healthiest part of you is your head.
Now... Moving on from these top pictures here, where we show these lesions in full swing, if we scroll down just a little bit, we show where the cannabis oil was in fact applied to his head and the reduction in the size of these lesions.
Yeah, but see, that was early on. Because the doctor had seen what was occurring, he then encouraged that he put it all over his head. because he didn't know where or where there was cancer or not. And at that point, they all coalesced into one, you know, total open valley up there. So he had a significant amount of cancer. And it was really the doctor observing that it had any effect that made him think, yeah, we better put it. Because what it does is it seems with these squamous cell cancers, it seems to extrude them from the body. We've seen that with some other cancers that are epithelial of origin. Epithelial means, you know, your skin, basically. But you keep in mind you have skin in the tube that runs through you, your alimentary canal. So I've had reports. None of it is appropriately medically documented, but anecdotal from people I know and who have the records. People literally defecated their tumors, both from a stomach tumor as well as a colon cancer, because they got extruded into the tube. There's two ways out, but the normal way out is what was taken.
So what are you saying here, that this guy took the cannabis oil, and we can see here he's it's really, really bad lesions coming out of his skull, and then they kind of seem to heal up, dry up, and then there's only like these two sort of like leftover little holes there covered by sort of fresh growth baby skin. Are you saying that what was actually happening here is the lesions were kind of becoming internal, like a root?
No, and then that killed them? That local lesions, when you put on enough all around, you see that there was cancer in places that were not where you were originally treating. So once the cannabis started to kill that, it just opened everything up again.
So he was only doing it topically, and it wasn't being taken internally at the same time. Would that have made the difference?
Initially, that's what was going on. In the end, he switched as well because of the pain relief. He needed pain relief. He couldn't deal with the narcotics anymore, and constipation, and, you know. So it wound up being very effective on multiple levels for the poor man. He was a very special, nice man.
Mm. And had he not gone to the hospitals and taken their antibiotics and treatments and so on and so forth, if he'd continued on with the regime of hemp oil?
Had another issue that arose that he had to deal with, and that's why he went to the hospital. But the fact that he had an open lesion on his head for, you know, over a year without any infection, I think is a confirmation of the antibiotic properties of these cannabis oils. And so he wasn't exposed. See, the thing with hospitals is, you know, it's easy to kill off the sensitive pathogens, but then you're stuck with the resistant ones. And that's unfortunately, you know, you go to the hospital, you are likely to get a resistant one, not a sensitive one, because everybody's on antibiotics. You select for the drug-resistant ones. That's why going to the hospital can be quite dangerous. You get a hospital infection.
Yeah. I do think that, of course, I guess some kind of a lame joke here about, like, French foreign lesions, but the other element that I think is very important to note here is that you were having quite a lot of very significant success in preventing infection. And what people do is they take one element that goes wrong or whatever, and then they blame the cannabis of it, right? You know, like if
there's too many people benefiting now for them to get away with that crap, you know? Mm. There are just too many examples, and the science, there's quite a load of science out there, despite the ridiculous statement that we don't have enough science. You know, if you look at cannabis, I've got about 12,000 references. And these are not, you know, kind of junk social references. Shows my bias there. But real science, biology, biochemistry, molecular biology, etc. And there's no way that any sane person could look at that literature, just even reading the titles, and not conclude that there's significant value to cannabinoids. You'd have to be a goddamn idiot. And yet our investigative agencies, you know, the people who advise our senators and our congresspeople and our military and law enforcement. How is it that they can't get beyond looking at the things that allow them to only see that it's bad? These people are trained investigators, our tax money at work, and all they've done with this cannabis story is prove utter incompetence.
They couldn't investigate their way out of a brown paper bag full of weed.
Well, you couldn't ask for anything more. You know, we have endocannabinoid systems. They regulate everything. The science is there. You got all the people using it with medical marijuana. You got a history of centuries of use. You know,
millennia of use. Millennia, 10,000 years of use. No, it's dangerous. It's not sad. Really, you got any science to prove that it's dangerous? Well, no, we just kind of made it up. Why did you make it up? Well, we kind of own a huge quantity of forest and stuff like that and paper mills so that, you know, if people were allowed to grow cannabis, they'd be able to make paper like six times as fast as we would, and it'd be like four or five times the quality like the Gutenberg Bible that still exists today because it was printed on hemp paper. And we're just not really ready to deal with that kind of competition because I'm a psychopathic control freak, really. And essentially, I don't like people muscling in on my business using honesty, integrity, and something that pulls radiation out of the ground because I also love cancer.
Are you talking about a blip?
Mm-hmm. This is the mentality that we're dealing with, isn't it? And I wonder if it's going to get... I don't like it when people talk about war all the time. Have you noticed? And... this is what's happening. There's actually a silent war going on, the blips versus the flips, and the flips don't even realize it for the most part, do they?
Well, that's why we need a revolution of consciousness, and that's what cannabis promotes. So the fact that we have an increased knowledge of the medicinal value manifesting itself as our demand for fundamental human rights. You know, we're voting for it. Colorado here, we legalized it, you know. And that brings up a real irritant to me. Yeah, you read it in the papers every day, this nonsense, this red herring about state versus federal, who's got the authority to regulate marijuana, blah, blah, blah. We are a democracy. We voted. We changed our state constitution. We, the people, you know, the government is for the people, by the people, not for the government, by the government.
So allegedly.
It doesn't matter whether it's state or federal. You went to the primary source. We send troops to other countries to fight for democracy, and then we're going to deny it here to our very own people because we don't like the outcome of their vote? Bullshit.
Hey, well, we can't swear on this particular radio broadcast, but I get your point. And it reminds me of a sketch by Jay Leno. He says, you know what we should do for the Iraqis? We should give them our constitution because we don't seem to be using it anymore.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's except Obama came out on the correct side now without properly, you know, fulfilling what any high school student could determine by doing an investigation. But at least he basically said, we're going to leave it up to the states as long as they regulate it in accordance with our federal requirements, meaning that it doesn't go to states where it's not legal and it's kept away from children appropriately and things that were, you know, semi-reasonable. In fact, you know, if the people in the state don't change it, well, then that's where they're at. You know,
that's what Obama says, and what he says and what he does tend to be two different things. And tell any hemp store in California that's selling medical quality cannabis to people with appropriate cards and identification and all of that kind of stuff, all above board, getting raided by the DEA from out of state.
That should now end as a result of what he just said yesterday. Because
just said this yesterday?
Yes, there was you missed out on the news. They basically acknowledged that Colorado and Washington have a right to legalize pot.
After they've already done it.
But they do admit it, you know? It's going to be all right, I think.
Well, let's hope so, because it's been... How many years now? It's been like 60, 70, like 80 years?
1937.
So in 4 years, it'll be like 70 years.
Yeah. It's insanity. But that, again, to me, is just proof of the biochemical, genetic nature of who's running the world. Now, you know, when you look, it turns out that the cannabinoid receptors first appeared from an evolutionary point of view with the emergence of vertebrates. So prior to vertebrates, there were the chemical equivalents. They go all the way back to protozoa, the earliest single-cell, you know, eukaryotic organisms, cells like we have. And as complexity evolved, when you developed the vertebrates, a whole new level of flexibility was introduced. You know, we have bones, we have skin, you work hard, your bones get thicker, your skin toughens, if calluses. We have a tremendous availability to adapting to our environment. Whereas the insects, you know, they have a hard shell. It can only grow so much. It turns out that with the emergence of vertebrates, that's when the cannabinoid receptors first appeared. And they wind up regulating all the things that give us the variability with respect to how we interface with our environment. You know, because they're regulating our bones, our muscles, our immune system. The more you're going around, the more you have to have an adaptable immune system, because you're exposing to new things all the time. You know, you got to make sure that you have a type of immunity that's going to help protect you against that, that's more sophisticated than what an insect has. They only have the innate immune system, which we have as well. We've added on top of that a new layer of complexity because of how it can be very protective.
So what occurs to me is that it's necessary for growth, healing, learning, a whole bunch of other things. You know, it's extraordinarily beneficial. And, you know, it's only beneficial for people who actually like the whole idea of things that are evolving, things that are developing, things that are getting better. Whereas those who have a different mindset have the direct opposite objectives. They want to make everything worse. They want to stop people from learning. They want to dumb everybody down. And they want to hurt and kill. We'll be right back after the break with Dr. Bob Melamed, ladies and gentlemen.
I got some so-called friends. I'll smile right to my face. All when my back is turned.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is the glowing skull of Dr. Bob Melamed from cannabisscience.com. And we were just like, I pinched him out of his run. He normally goes for a bit of a run sort of thing in order to come on this radio show. So during the break, he's like, oh, man, I need to go for a run. Just like, well, you know, don't shilly-shally, don't dilly-dilly. So we were both working out on the break, and I feel like, pumped, yeah! And we're going to change topics a little bit. Because Bob always talks about this, okay? Always talking about endocannabinoids, always talking about the blips and flips, always talking about this, that, and the other. And, you know, even if you're really interested in something, if that's all you're talking about, eventually it starts to lose the mojo just a little bit. So we're going to switch it up. We're going to talk about the physics of life itself. Bob, what are the physics of life, to your understanding?
Well, the physics of life has to do with a branch of physics that was created by Nobel laureate Ilya Prigogine when he developed the field known as far from equilibrium thermodynamics. And what he basically shows, in contrast to what existed before that, is a way by which you would actually expect life to occur, as opposed to having life being looked at as an impossible miracle. The standard thermodynamics says life is too improbable, it could never happen. Whereas the far from equilibrium thermodynamics demonstrates via a number of examples where you have basically the organization of molecules occurring because energy is able to flow through them more efficiently when they are organized, and in doing so, generate more disorder, which is known as entropy, to the surroundings. So basically what I'm saying is that a collection of molecules can organize itself
as long as it does so by making its surroundings more entropic. And
can you
this provides
that?
For the formation of... Well, entropy is randomness, and negative entropy would be organization. So living beings are very organized. They're very negentropic. And yet, a fundamental law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics, states that entropy must always increase, but really more specifically in a closed system. And we're not a closed system. And when you're not, you know, because we're eating and giving off heat and getting rid of our wastes, as long as we have flow going through us, we wind up generating more disorder to our environment, to the universe, than would occur if we were not here. So because of that, that's what makes us be here. That's what makes us chemically and physically sound. So with this kind of approach and this kind of understanding, you would naturally expect life to emerge as energy from the sun and the geothermal earth was being transferred because you're having the flow of energy. And you would have things like acidity and alkalinity in different parts of the oceans for different reasons. And, you know, all of these factors allow for flow. And whenever you can have flow, you can organize into what's called flow-dependent structures. And that's what created the richness of the prebiotic soup that could then coalesce as the sustenance to have life emerge. Well, the emergence of life is really a far from equilibrium phase change. Like, you know, going to ice is more negentropic than having water. But that's an equilibrium structure. It doesn't need exchange. Whereas we require that constant input and output to sustain our very organization, our being. And that's true not only with respect to our life, but the manifestations of life, social structure, political, economic, etc., are all natural manifestations of the increase in chemical, biochemical complexity that results when you have, you know, 4 billion years of the Earth being hit by sunlight and re-irradiating to the universe.
I was just thinking about this the other day, and I want to get your take on it. The difference between somebody who gets a lot accomplished in their life versus the person who does the same all the time is the person who gets a lot accomplished thinks about life in terms of possibilities. The person who does nothing with their life thinks about it in terms of probability. Probability states that tomorrow will be the same as today. Probability states that my job will pay me money and I will probably use that money to buy food and or pay rent and so on and so forth. Possibility is, what if I quit my job? What if I started up a new product? What if I decided to change the world in an entrepreneurial type fashion? Is that what the crux of the issue here with this flow that you're talking about is? Flow increases the amount of available possibilities and doesn't make probability quite so rigid and allows for different things to develop, different organisms to come into existence, so to speak.
Well, that's basically correct, because the probability from a static point of view of creating one protein would be 1 out of 20, 1 out of 20, 100 times, which turns out to be more than the number of particles believed to exist in our universe. So just to create one protein would be so improbable that it would never happen. How could you conceivably create a cell or a living organism like humans with such improbable events? And the reason is because that's not the way things work. It's not time-independent throwing of the dice for each instant, but rather it's an unfolding process where energy utilization to organize and at the same time dissipate waste is a natural process that drives the formation of complexity and of evolution and of humanity and within humanity, you know, the progress of civilization. And now, because we have gained so much control over our environment, unfortunately, with the lack of consciousness and the lack of awareness of what is driving us, this simple natural unfolding phenomena, we now have to kind of step back, both from a personal as well as a societal point view, and try to understand the impact that we're having on our environment that sustains us, because we are flow dependent structures. You can't have a collapse of the flow, you know? So we need more open-minded, peaceful people. We shouldn't be, you know, in America, it shouldn't be our number one industry, arms sales. You know, it's ludicrous. They worry about country while the country is the largest arms dealer in the world.
I've got a correction for you there. Actually, America's now number one export is scrap metal.
Well, that's actually
scrap metal and waste paper, I think, are number one and number two of America's top exports. And what does that say about the state of the country?
No, the fact that they're exporting recyclables and that there's value in recyclables is...
We're having some real problems with your Skype connection there, Bob. We're having some real problem with your Skype there. Are you able to turn off any web browsers or email or anything else that you've got going on during the Skype call? You might have been close.
Well, no, what just happened was somebody on Skype called me.
Oh, right.
I'll put up a do not disturb sign.
Mm-mm-mm. Hang a sock on your Skype door handle.
Yes.
Like they do in the dorm rooms. This dorm is rocking. So anyway.
Oh, I'm losing you now.
Yeah. Okay. That's not good. Yeah. You seem to be sort of frozen as well. AFR, could we hang up and reconnect Bob just quickly and see if that
that
resets it and makes it better? All right. We've just disconnected Bob, and we shall be reconnecting him in a second now, ladies and gentlemen. Now, this is an interesting discussion as well, because it's interesting how a lot of things tie in together. You can turn your webcam back on now, Bob. It's interesting how things tie in together, how you can tie in science, spirituality, evolution, and just basic politics and philosophy together. And that's what I find is very interesting about the structure of the universe, is that virtually nothing exists in isolation. Everything's always affecting everything else in a lot of ways. There's nothing that doesn't have an effect, in other words.
Yeah, we live in a holistic universe, and that becomes more dramatic when you look at the local level of our planet. You know, it's quite incredible. But I think where the aspects of the beauty of understanding this kind of science is that you develop the understanding that you also are simply one of these flow-dependent structures, and that your life is regulated by the laws of physics that created you. So as you can better understand what those laws are and how they created you, then you can try to shape your consciousness so that you'll be more in tune with survivability, essentially,
your connection's really bad there,
sustaining yourself, because you are seeing what is good and what is bad in terms of me about it. I just bought a booster the other day, too, and we're on that.
Yeah, this is just impossible.
Everything looks
good
on this end.
Could you type in?
We'll
connect you back after. Yeah, sorry. We'll connect you back after the break using your phone number. So if you want to type in your phone, we'll keep you on Skype here just with your mic muted so we can have the video feed, and we'll just give you the audio through the phone. Is that possible there for you, Bob?
Yeah, we can try that. Let me see my phone's charged up. Yeah.
All right, good. All right, so we'll be back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Dr. Bob Melamed. So, Bob, just type your number into the little Skype chat here, and we'll connect you on that just after the break. Well, as soon as possible. So, yeah.
Wounded station in the belly of the vulture. Watch your back. There's no civilians, women, children, frontline prison. Consider this a distant early warning. The fire's imminent, pollution gathering dust particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation to fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Welcome back. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the Fukushima irradiated island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, where it's so bright and sunny that everybody has a part time job as an energy saver light bulb because there's just that much mercury in our tuna as well. And my very special guest, who measures the mercury, the temperature of the mind, and the structure and the flow of the universe, bro, is Dr. Bob Melamed. Welcome back.
Howdy.
Okay, so he's got his cell phone on his chest. That'll be good for your EMF frequency generation, and also the laptop. Now, did you know, Bob, that if you put a laptop on your lap, after about 30 minutes, over half of your sperm will die, and the other half won't be able to swim?
Well, that's why I take cannabinoids, to help protect my body.
Does it actually have that real effect? Like, have we done tests in order to, say, protect people from radiation? Because I mentioned Fukushima just before, for example. Now, yeah. I do know that that cannabis plants do tend to suck up the radiation from soil in contaminated lands. However, what does it do with that radiation once it's sucked it up into the plant? Does it just remain in the plant forever, or has it got a way of getting rid of it?
That allows you to reclaim the land, and then you got to deal with the radiation that's in the plants. But you could extract that then and then concentrate it. So rather than having a contaminated land, you've got a little jar of radioactive poison.
I suppose that's probably a lot easier, you know.
You know, it's healthier. It'd be better to not have the problem in the first place.
Well, yeah, I think that would probably be an idea. Which reminds me, I saw a documentary the other day talking about, I think it might have been some socialist or whatever, talking about how people, you know, unfairly demonize nuclear power and how it's really safe and everything like that. And even if it was really safe, every single nuclear power plant in the world is built on an earthquake fault line, okay? So no matter how safe it is, any earthquake at any time could potentially destroy, like, the whole world. How is that safe? What kind of reasoning process is going on in the minds of these people who promote nuclear energy? Sure.
The reasoning goes in their pocketbooks.
Uh-huh. What's the point? Okay, I don't know about you. In fact, I do know about you because you're the same as me. The point of being alive is to improve life, both for yourself and for those around you. If you ain't doing that, then you're not here for any good, decent purpose. Right? How exactly can we reconcile this? Because I watched this video this morning, Bob, of Luke Rutkowski from WeAreChange.org talking about how to deal with really depressing, negative BS that we're confronted with all of the time. And I wanted to know what your method is. Or is it just simply having a joint?
Well, again, it's a matter of taking in information and what do you do with it, you know, and what are you doing with yourself to try and minimize that which you don't like getting in the first place. You know, it's part of these feedback loops again. It's, again, natural collection of molecules cooperating with one another at this higher level of our consciousness and the society that we create. You got to either learn to be participant and have some kind of a vision as to what a positive change would be, or you just, you know, the sheeple floating along in the crap of the so-called leaders.
Is it simply down to that, having optimism and kind of hope for the future, having a positive outlook? Is that what will stop negativity from kind of taking root? Like, There's a war going to happen in Syria. There's mandatory government vaccination programs. There's 7 billion hollow point rounds being ordered by the Department of Defense, enough for 4 bullets per man, woman, and child in the U.S. These are all facts, right? Yet, if you've got a positive outlook, it doesn't matter how discouraging or terrifying the facts are, because you're capable of transmuting them and making something better happen, aren't you? Oh, his phone's gone down. So, Bob, if you just...
I lost you on Skype.
Oh, you lost me on Skype.
I lost you on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you. All right. So, what I was saying there is that despite... You can't hear me? Turn your volume up. Turn your volume up there, and that should work. Can you hear me now? No. AFR, could you reconnect Bob on the Skype, please? And we'll see if we can get him back up again that way.
Okay.
Having some. Yeah. I can hear you speak. I can hear you. You. Me? No. It's very difficult to communicate. Okay.
Call me.
Well, call me. Just start speaking. Go on. No? Hanging up. What's going on here? Okay. Sorry about this, ladies and gentlemen.
Some major technical. Oh, okay. I can hear you now over Skype.
Okay.
Whew. Yeah, I had Skype calls and then phone calls. Somebody keeps trying to get a hold of me. One of the people that I work with.
Please turn your speakers down, though, because there's a bit of feedback.
Hang on. How's that?
Testing.
Can you hear still me okay now?
I can still hear you, but it's just that I can also hear myself talking back to myself across the feedback. And we still have somebody trying to call you. That's probably American Freedom Radio trying to call you. Did they
draw? Do you want me to be on the phone again?
Yeah. You know.
Okay.
If that works. But you have to mute your Skype mic, of course, once you answer the phone. Mate, ladies and gentlemen, I seriously apologize for this. This has been what's the word? It rhymes with Usterpluck. an on-air Usterpluck. Like a duck. Bob, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. Yes, indeed.
You're loud and clear, but you're not on camera no more. You've got it pointed away from you. That's fine. All right, here we go. So my point was, dealing with negativity, right? All this negative stuff comes at you. You know, there's bullets being ordered by the government. There's tyrannical legislation. There's wars. There's famine. There's vaccines. There's viruses. There's such and such. Blah blah blah. Yet, if you've got a positive outlook and if you have a vision for the future that actually involves something good happening and not giving into the darkness, not giving into the evil, not giving into the bad news, you're actually capable, therefore, of transmuting all of that negativity into something good. And I'm not talking about just some kind of ethereal, airy-fairy type of stuff. You can actually turn bad news into good news with your mind, with your outlook, with your actions. And I think that the blips have figured this out, and they're trying to prevent the flips from figuring it out, that you can literally change human destiny with your own actions. And I think that's why a lot of people are really negative and depressed all the time, is because they've forgotten how innately, incredibly powerful they can be.
I would largely agree with that.
How exactly can we reconcile this? How exactly can we change this? Just in terms of a mental state of view, in terms of thinking, what would you advise people who are upset, afraid, scared of all this news and everything and all this fear porn that's being thrown at them day to day? How can you help people in their mode of thinking?
Well, what that's really reflecting is, again, a lack of sufficient cannabinoid activity to deal with those stress levels. So they can try taking essential fatty acids, in particular omega-3, long chain, like fish oil or krill oil. And the reason those are so important is that's how your body makes its pot. Your endocannabinoids are made out of essential fatty acids, both omega-6s and omega-3s. And the fish oil is good in that it has the long chain omega-3s that your endocannabinoid system uses to make themselves, basically. So that's one thing you can do. And I've seen behavioral changes resulting from that. You know, one of my sons has a tendency to get overly angry at times. And he doesn't do that when he has his oil. And when we forget for a while, those are always the times that it winds up happening. You know, so at this point, we, I think, all pretty much firmly believe that there's that connection, and it does make sense as well, scientifically and, you know, observationally. So,
incidentally, hemp seed is high in those omegas, isn't it?
Hemp seed has a good ratio of 6 to 3, 3 to 6s. You don't want too many 6s because they have the ability to go down a biochemical pathway that could be inflammatory. And in general, most of the better things in terms of health-related are when you shift that thermostat a little bit towards anti-inflammatory. You got to appreciate how we got here, you know? 150 years ago, we were dying at 40 years old on the average, or 50 at the latest, you know? And we were dying from infections. And in general, the way we protect ourselves and the way most organisms protect themselves from infection is by making inflammatory biochemical responses as part of our immune response. So there's a balance. Everything in again, from the physics, everything is in balance. So inflammation is in balance with turning it off. So you have a thermostat
thing again. Is that why politicians are prone to giving inflammatory remarks?
Well, they're fighting each other. You know, the two sides of the aisle are always fighting each other. But by doing so, they sustain each other. So what I'm talking about is shifting that set point on a immunological level. Because today, now that we are eating better than we did 150 years ago, we have a less stressful life in many respects because we have, you know, gas heat, or you don't have to go chop your wood, and you have a diversity of food all year round, and we have antibiotics. It's a good drug, you know. So today we're living longer, and the main cause of death today is not infection in westernized societies, but rather age-related illnesses. And all the age-related illnesses, meaning autoimmune, cognitive dysfunction, cardiovascular problems, bone issues, and cancers, they all have a free radical association with their etiology. And your cannabinoid system is what minimizes that free radical production. So it inhibits all of those features, so to speak, that are characteristic of aging, which is why it's an anti-aging drug. And, you know, that you can see that in the sense that if you eliminate the gene, again, that CB1 receptor, those mice die prematurely. And they're super fearful. You know, they don't want to move around because just moving is too stressful. You know, they're the ultimate blip. So we need more cannabinoid activity in the human population, and that's what's happening right now with the movement moving forward as more and more people understand the health benefits, both from a preventive as well as a treatment point of view.
So. When we talk about this kind of development of humanity, going from being closed off, greedy, and negative and depressing, we're talking about being more open, we're talking about being happier, and we're talking about being more creative. So open mind, creative potential, fueled by high energy, happiness, right? Is that essentially the main hallmarks of a non-cannabinoid deficient person?
Yeah, you know, and from the population point of view, we need to adjust the thermostat so that, you know, we don't want to increase our infection rate, but on the other hand, right now we're dying from age-related illnesses. Let's just, you know, tone that down a little. That's why people take antioxidants. That's why we exercise. Exercise moves you further from equilibrium. It goes back to the physics again. You know, when you're healthy, you're further from equilibrium. As you age and decline, you get closer to equilibrium, and death is a phase change that represents your loss of flow-dependent organization.
Mm. Can I make a couple of points, though? You raised a point earlier that people were dying earlier and that kind of thing. Did you get that information by chance from the law of averages, like the averaged out deaths? Because I heard that was a myth. Because what happens is there was a very high mortality rate as infants, but in terms of people living longer and everything like that, it wasn't terribly similar from 70 to 80 years old or significantly different from our average life today. It's just, except we're far more likely to survive today. And the law on averages is that you had a pretty high chance of infant mortality, so it skewed the figures to make it look like everybody was dying at 40 when it was the people who died.
Well,
died
it may early. Not have been that. It may not have in reality been like the straight average would suggest because of what you indicated, the high rate of infant mortality. That's true, but keep in mind also that the United States has one of the much higher rates of infant mortality. And if you look at, you know, the average age, survival rate, it's been increasing. And if you look at areas of the world that in many respects might be more analogous to the United States 200 years ago, you see that they have those problems. Because without sanitation, for example, you're going to, you know, come down with more illness. It's common sense.
The other element is age-related illnesses. Some have said that they're, in fact, simply accumulative toxins, and it's not so much age-related illnesses that are killing people. In fact, I think one of the number one killers in America is like obesity, heart disease. You have a look at the typical American diet, the amount of pesticides, herbicides, goodness what other asides that are put into the food that's being eaten, the fluoride and the cancer-causing properties of that within the water. And before you know it, you got a 1 in 3 cancer rate. You got everybody starting to get arthritis. You got autism levels spiking off the charts. And it seems to me that health is starting to be greatly affected by the gradual and, I believe, deliberate accumulation of toxins in the American food, water, and air supply.
Well, toxins, you know, are again our contact with our environment. And again, it's our environment that sustains us. So when you take in things that are toxins, you're not doing the correct thing. Remember, I talked about modifying the lens of your mind. You know, if the lens of your mind doesn't know and understand these basic principles, of which nutrition is one, then you go down the wrong road. And especially if you're indoctrinated.
That's a good point. Hold on. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Bob Mann. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, Monday through Friday in the US of SA. And if I do that in a Mexican accent, actually, there's quite a lot of immigration going on there illegal in the US, SA. And in New Zealand, it's Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. till midday. And in about a month's time, time zone changes, you know, with the old daylight savings and what have you. Summer's on its way. That's so good. I hate the cold. I hate the cold very, very much. A lot of people say that, oh, you know, you're in New Zealand, you don't know what cold is. I lived in Minnesota for such and blah, blah. Dude, you have not lived in Dunedin, okay? You have not seen your olive oil freeze at room temperature, okay? I don't care what you've seen. You have not seen that. And until the inside is 5 degrees colder than the outside, on average, you don't know what real cold is. That's what I'm talking about. No insulation, no nothing, huddling next to a dryer for the winter because it's the only thing in the house that's freaking warm. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about cold. Speaking of cold, we're going to warm things up a little bit. And we're talking about some lighthearted, happy things because what I've found is really great about being a creative, intelligent person is that you learn how to create ways to amuse yourself even when things just really aren't that funny. Stoner comedy. I was just yesterday, I was thinking about the genius of Cheech and Chong. Do you agree, Bob?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, man, am I driving okay?
I think we're parked, man.
You know, and this is what I think is starting to actually become a lot more prominent now in the entertainment industry and television shows and a lot of films that I've been watching. Is it was actually quite rare in films in the past, I've found, to see people, you know, just whipping out, smoking a joint or whatever, and now it's becoming a lot more common. It's starting to feed more into the mass culture, the mass consciousness. Have you noticed the same phenomenon?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Things are loosening up. I've been following this for many decades.
Well, what was it like back in the day versus what it's like today? I mean, from your perspective over time.
Well, I remember back in the 60s, we could smoke pot in a lot of restaurants and movie theaters in New York. You weren't harassed. That was before Nazi Rudy Giuliani and Bloomberg.
Yeah. Well, go on.
No, things are changing. And I used to talk about it quite a long time ago. The medical marijuana reality has to drive this because as stupid as we are, collectively we will not cut off our heads despite our body. Because that's the magnitude of what we've done by preventing this medicine and this nutritional value as antioxidants, as age-preventing properties. It's insane. I mean, it's in mother's milk. This is one of my favorite stories. It's in mother's milk. Psychoactive cannabinoids. Not the same chemical structure as THC. But the endocannabinoids that we produce that regulate things like how happy or sad we are, you know, how high or unhigh we are, right? And they're in mother's milk. So the first thing a mother does is she gives, a smart mother does, is she gives her kids some cannabis boost. You know, the kid has just gone through childbirth all that time in the canal there, getting squished around while his head is crunched. And then it comes out and it breathes oxygen at a much higher level than it was exposed to in utero via the placenta. And pure oxygen is toxic. You know, years ago, they tried to treat premature babies with pure oxygen and made them blind. But thankfully, they don't do that anymore. But and then it also stimulates the appetite of the newborn. So the kid bonds with the mother. So what I believe is a distinct possibility, I think this is a very interesting hypothesis, is that the blips are people who were not nursed as children, so that they're still suffering from post-birth traumatic stress disorder. You know, because they lack that comfort and binding and neuroprotective properties that had elicited stress responses within them. And they become epigenetic so that it's conceivable that not only those people, but their children. You know, it's like Cheney and his daughter.
I scarcely want to think of that image. And think about childbirth today has been made almost artificially traumatic too, hasn't it? You're born into fluorescent light, which is overload for new eyes. You have a person in a very scary mask looking down at you. You're not being held to somebody's skin upon first contact, say, with your mother. You're wrapped up, bundled up, like in a cocoon of all these blankets to protect and you and everything that, like that.
If you're conscious enough, you can request that. They put the baby on your chest before they even cut the umbilical cord.
Yeah, key word
the right
there, if.
And the right doctor, it's not the standard always.
Yeah, well, just hear me out. Then after that, you get vaccinated, so you're getting jabbed with a needle. So your first experience is extremely bright lights, scary guy in a mask, can't move, and getting jabbed with a needle. All right? That's got to cause some long-lasting trauma for those that it actually happens to. Wouldn't you think?
Well, Well, that's why they need the cannabinoids all the more that are in mother's milk.
Hmm. I once met a friend of mine who's from Ngāruawhia. And it's a place famous in New Zealand, you know, the word Ngāruawhia, kind of is synonymous with a smoking culture. And he used to joke that as soon as you get born, you get given a beer in one hand and a joint in the other, and then you go home to your parents. And this is the strange culture that I think we've all grown up with now, is that it's from cradle to grave, essentially. You've got so many deliberate influences in your life that aren't positive. And unless you're conscious that this is going on, you can't escape them because you're not even aware that they're affecting you, right?
Yep. Well, that's why cannabis promotes self-awareness. And that's why it's been so dangerous to the establishment and the blips, because it does promote change. And it typically, I believe, has a greater probability of promoting intelligent change rather than stupid change. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a time when aggression and dominance was good, because you had a tribal, you know, society, and you had to have some level of organization and control. So there was times, you know, as man evolved, where having organizational power through control actually benefited man's, you know, societal evolution. But now we've passed that point. There are too many people. We produce and utilize too many resources, so that the only thing that's going to allow for long-term survival is to come up with appropriate means of sustainability. You know, I mean, we can pray, so to say, for miracles down the road that would give us unlimited energy sources and blah, 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 blah. But dealing with what we have right now, you know, we have to wisen up a little bit and be a little more conscious as to what we're doing and how we're poisoning the planet and destroying the environment that is necessary for sustaining our very existence.
Here's a question for you. How can we deal with where we are right now if we have no idea where we are or who we are?
Well, you can have the idea by understanding the physics of life of what you are. And by understanding what you are, and then you plug into that, you know, the specifics of the of your life's experience, that's what would shape the possibility of what you can become. When you integrate how you've gotten where you are, and then through awareness gain an extra level of flexibility in your mind, then you can rechannel and set up your thinking for the future. You know, we do things that make us unhappy. You can't dwell on the unhappiness of the present. What you have to do is plan to minimize that occurrence in the future. And by minimize, I don't mean necessarily the phenomena itself, but your response to it. Because, you know, for any circumstance, you can respond in so many different ways. Are there ways that are consistent with it being less stressful and more healthy? And will they automatically be apparent to us once we understand better the nature of our being?
I don't know, very important thought here, but I've forgotten what it was. You know how interesting and annoying that can be. You have this set goal in mind. You know, in life, everybody's got these set goals, and you make those set goals based upon what your environment is, you know, what you've been brought up to believe. You know, you've been brought up in a seminary or something like that. Your goal is to, I don't know, sexually abuse young boys in a choir. And let's say you're brought up in the Rothschild family or the Rockefeller family or something of that nature. You don't feel like you had to earn anything. You know, you were born into it, right? How much life experience do these people who have these set paths laid out by, say, parents or whatever, and actually have a lot of control over their own life? Now, can we, as a society, even figure out ways to raise children to be their own person, or will they always generally draw their traits and their abilities from their genes and how they're raised, kind of thing? Or is it possible to change things altogether?
Well, I mean, in the ideal circumstance, what the parents would do, and I've got three sets of children, what the parents would do would be provide the child with the developmental environment that they would have the security and the knowledge of fluidity, and so that they had the direction and understanding in a general sense, and then they would just explore that and fit it to their own specifics. That's empowering them.
So it's about kind of what, challenging children and giving them rewards from an early on? I mean, there's lots of positive lessons you can instill, and I found that the easiest way to teach somebody a positive lesson is provide a positive example.
Absolutely.
And they tend to copy what they see.
Absolutely. You know, if you got a bunch of drunken parents that sit around being drunk, that's a different situation than if you had parents who might be like my kids. They know what I do. I'm fighting for us to have the rights as human beings to use this plant as a medicine, because everything I understand about science tells me it's good. And I have an obligation to myself, my family and friends and society to try to become part of that, manifest that.
Why do you feel that obligation? What actually obliges you?
I think because it seems that a natural trait among people is that I believe, just because it's true on a molecular level, cooperation is our natural way. But because of fear and insecurity, we're in a mode where we have, again, changed the thermostat so that there's a higher level of cooperativity. It's the cooperativity on a molecular level that allowed for the initiation and continued progression of complexity manifest in evolution and everything that evolution manifests, you know, in terms of humans with society, etc. So we're part of that. There's no way to get around that. And what we can do is to try and understand, again, what we are, so that our decision-making process is going to be consistent, again, with us surviving and thriving. It's a really good movie, Thrive Something, I just saw the other day.
Yeah, I had Foster Gamble on the show. We had a right hot time. It was a fun interview. Good guy.
Yeah, that was very, very impressive. But anyway, you know, I think...
Well, that's actually kind of a good example. You take Procter and Gamble, Foster Gamble, rather, and you have a look at the environment that he was raised into, you know, all this wealth and that kind of thing. And yet, now towards later part of his life, he's devoting himself to the thing called the Thrive Movement for the benefit of all of humanity. So it's kind of an interesting case study that sort of proves the point that it matters not how you're raised. It matters not the gifts or endowments you're given. You can make good out of anything if you choose to.
If you're lucky enough to choose, because what is there really such a thing as free choice or not?
Maybe not if you're fatalistic. I believe that there's free choice is a depressing thought. Ergo, I choose to not believe in it.
So I don't particularly believe in free choice. I think we're all part of our individual, unique unfolding, and that of the choices, with quotes around them, that we might have before us at any one instant, there are certain ones that are going to be consistent with our biochemical unfolding and others that are inconsistent. And we'll, you know, it's a probabilistic thing depending on how we're feeling that day or whatever. It's all just part of this chemistry, this flowing chemistry. We are, in many respects, just a delusion.
Well, and indeed, that might be what's probabilistic, but I prefer to look at, as we said earlier, what's possible, rather than just what's probable. Because what's probable can often be quite negative, and what's possible, infinitely positive. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com with Dr. Bob Miller. I'm back. As Jimi Hendrix said, there must be some kind of way out of here, said the flips to the blips. And my very special guest, Bob Malamede, has... Well, I just want to say thanks, Bob, because frankly, I had like four or five guest possibilities for today.
you weren't even one of the possibilities, and then you turned up when everybody else cancelled out. And that was just great. Because we wanted to do a roundtable with yourself, Rick Simpson, Ian Jacklin, who's making a documentary about cancer cures, and Danny Panzella, who's also a prominent cannabis activist and filmmaker, I think, in his own right. And what would be good, and I wanted to get your perspective on this in terms of the blips and flips and blah, 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 is to get a whole bunch of people of like mind round together, open minds that are like-minded. Is that a contradiction in terms, or is that just how things really, really get expanded on much more rapidly? Can you hear me, Bob?
Yeah, I can. I didn't know you were waiting. Open-minded is the paradigm. The specific examples are, you know, unique to the individuals. So everybody is different, as we discussed with, you know, mice in a cage or different biochemically. So it's a matter of selecting for positive interactions and moving forward in a positive direction, you know?
Mm. Now, you were talking about how you're not sure if there's such a thing as free choice or free will.
Exactly.
You ever had a reptilian brain response? You know, when you get really angry at somebody when they say something to you and you yell something out of them or whatever, and you get uber Angus, you know, kind of like beef. And you know that if you'd taken a few deep breaths and counted to 10, you wouldn't have said the same thing, you know? You can choose not to react like that.
Well,
and everything that you do is...
Are you doing the only thing that your biochemistry would let you do?
Mm.
There's no way of discerning that.
Learning, on the other hand. Like, for example, if you do have those responses and then you go to an anger management clauses and it shows you what the warning signs are and so on and so forth, then you learn to behave differently. Learned behavior, I think, is one of the primary functions of free will, because if you know how to control your will through learning, it becomes a freer will, does it not?
I think that knowing that you have no free will gets you closer to having any.
How is that? Could you define it?
Well, because if I'm right and we're all just a probabilistic unfolding, and the key there is probabilistic as opposed to mechanical, you know, because of the nature of the physics of flow-dependent structures, there's always a probabilistic component to the way things occur. And different people with different genetics and different biochemistry will have a different repertoire of possibilities at any one time. And, so, you know, we can't really know if we've ever made a choice or if that was the only choice we could have made.
It must be a possibility. It must be a possibility then, because if we can't decide that it's certainly not, then it's probable that it might be. Or possible, rather. And I remember this, we said this on another show, I don't think it was with you, it was with somebody else, but in a probabilistic reality, anything is possible. In a cannibalistic reality, anyone is edible.
I've heard that. but see, everything isn't possible. The possibility of you turning into a beautiful woman overnight is not going to happen.
What about with surgery?
That's still a different phenomenon. You know, there are.
I've got the cheekbones for it, darling.
You know, you could go and have the surgery. That's among the possible options. The chances of it happening independent of anything, you're just waking up one day and looking in the mirror and going, wow, that's not very likely to occur.
Yeah, I mean, despite what Freaky Friday movies will tell you. The other element here is, it's kind of like we talked about positivity. Does not believing that there's such a thing as free choice, is that a positive notion or a negative notion, or is it neither?
I would tend to think it's neither, because it might be nothing more than what's real, in which case you know, the better we can participate in some positive sense with the creative force that it made us, that's kind of like, you know, essentially following the will of God, so to speak. You know, we have this process that has gotten us here, and there are some people who are going to fight it, and there are going to be some people who are going to take it, you know, take it to a new level, and some people will just float along. You always have to have a variety of possibilities at any one moment, and then, you know, ideally, cooperative, positive ones are the ones that emerge. In the long term, I believe they do.
Indeed, it's quite possible for that to happen. And I was just thinking, you know, as we look back at, say, the Foster Gamble example, somebody could have been born and most predominantly their set path might not have been particularly positive, yet they made a choice and changed that reality. Now, if that's possible, despite all the odds, like you take me, for example, criminal convictions, father wasn't there for a large portion of my life, no inheritance to speak of, emotional trauma, a paranoid fear of being employed, and so on and so forth. You know, I've got all this bad stuff that has happened to me, and yet I believe it is, as you mentioned before, kind of like the will of God for me to get over all of that and do something positive with my life. Now, is that the divine speaking? In your assumption, what is the divine? I mean, is it like, you know, in Star Wars, how they said the midichlorians, these microscopic organisms that reside in all living things that continuously tell us the will of the Force? Is that actually what the endocannabinoids are? Are they the little things that are telling us the will of the divine?
In a sense, they are, because the more in harmony you are and the more fluid you are, that is the nature of divinity, from what I believe, because then you're able to participate better in the unfolding, which is, you know, your place in time and space, your karma. We're all in, you know, we all emerge from different histories. And, you know, that's just the way things are. Some of us are going to be more in tune in one way or another than others in one way or another. We're all unique entities exploring what can best fit with the future. Mm. And again, I always said it's time to replace blips with blips as leaders.
I was thinking the other day that if you want to be fatalistic about things, you know, like say, oh, it was meant to happen, or that was my destiny, or that was my fate, you can't say it beforehand, can you? You can't say it's my destiny or my fate to be the CEO of McDonald's Corporation, or my destiny or my fate to be American Idol. Once you are American Idol, once you are the CEO of McDonald's, then you go, well, I guess it was my fate, or I guess it was my destiny. When I think in having a belief in what your fate and your destiny is, instead of just reinventing yourself really on a day-to-day basis as things come at you, the only way it can ever possibly be accurate is through retrospect. Ergo, the eternal now is what's really important for you to focus your energy on, not your fate or your destiny, which is far off.
No, I agree with you. You know, what you're saying is right, because the only thing that's real is now.
Everything else is just, I don't know, ghosts in the mist.
It's a memory or a projection, but in either case, you know, how different is a memory from a projection?
Depends how much cannabis you've had, I guess.
Pardon me?
Depends how much cannabis you've ingested.
Yeah, that has a definite effect on those attitudes and directions, for sure. But the fact is that ever since the endocannabinoid system with respect to receptors evolved, the biochemical complexity of the successive phyla of organisms until we got up to humans here, it's always played an increasing role in our brain and, in fact, in the higher centers of our brain. So the thing that's so mind-blowing, and hopefully it's being taught finally in some of our professional organizations like med school, is that our endocannabinoid receptor system in our brain is the most abundant receptor system in our brain. Imagine that. And we've outlawed our personal right to turn it off or turn it on, depending on what our needs might be and what options we might have. It's criminal insanity.
That's like outlawing food being consumed through the mouth.
I didn't hear all of that.
I said that's like outlawing all food that can be consumed orally.
It is, because it's really the way it winds up regulating energy. And remember, it's the flow of energy through mass that organizes mass. So by regulating the flow of energy and free radical production in us, the cannabinoid system has a very extremely central role in our very being. And, you know, some people need to turn it up more. Some people might need to turn aspects of it down more. You know, and we should have the right. It's such a basic human right. To deny us that is just fascist Nazi crap.
You know what? I'm going to go to a protest this Sunday, and we're protesting for a number of different issues. It's the first combined protest where, you know, all the fluoride activists, people who are anti-government surveillance, anti-government tyranny, and people who are anti-cannabis prohibition, and so on and so forth and everything. And I reckon that'd be a good sign to have, Bob. Weed, it's a human right. Weed, it brings people together. Weed, yeah. It should be legalized. Thank you, Bob, for all that you do. Your wisdom and your knowledge in this particular instance, and cannabisscience.com, is it?
Yeah.
.org. Yeah, cannabisscience.com, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you again sometime. Don't you go anywhere.